Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Ofcom call to discuss the approaching and promoting competition and investment in fibre network. The call is hosted by Jonathan Oxley, Ofcom Interim Chief Executive. My name is Joan, I'm your event coordinator. During the presentation, your lines will remain on listen only. If you require assistance at any time, just key star 0 on your telephone and a coordinator will be happy to assist. I'd like to advise all parties this conference is being recorded for replay purposes, which will be available later on, together with the transcript of the call on the Ofcom website. And I'd now like to hand it over to Jonathan. Please go ahead, Jonathan.
Thank you, Jane, and good morning to everyone on the call. I think we've got a very extensive list of people. I think we've got about 50 people on the call. So with me this morning, I've got David Clarkson, who's a competition group director, and I've got Rohit Goel, who many of you will know, for our analyst relations manager. So through the presentation portion of this call, which we'll try to keep reasonably brief so that there's plenty of time for Q&A, we'll be referring to a set of slides, which if you haven't already, you can download from the analyst relations section on the Ofcom website. And as I say, once we've completed the presentation, there'll be an opportunity to ask questions. Okay, so I'll just give a quick sort of cant around the highlights of what I think we're doing today, and then I'll hand over to David to go through a bit more of the detail behind the proposals we've set out today. I guess there were two main areas that I think it's important for investors and analysts to focus on. The first is what is a very radical departure from our historic approach of orientating prices to Openreach's costs. For the first time, we are now departing from that. We're trying to encourage competitors to enter the market, and as a result of that, we're setting prices that are more akin to the prices that we think are reasonable for reasonably efficient competitors to BT and not just the incumbent's cost base. And that means that prices through the regulated products in the areas where we think competition can take place will go up in line with inflation. We're capping it to CPI, but that's a significant departure from the past. If you imagine the past, the counterfactual would have probably been a CPI minus X type arrangement. And the upshot of that is we're injecting a lot of additional margin and returns for the whole industry in terms of the network builders. So effectively, this is very pro-infrastructure. We've also, as you'll see, we'll talk about later, included a premium on our anchor price, the 40 megabit price, anchor price for when the service is provided over full fibre, and that reflects the benefit consumers and businesses will get from using a full fibre service and the savings that are made through the value chain from full fibre, from, for example, fewer faults. And the second thing I wanted to highlight, which is particularly relevant to BT and to Openreach, is what we're doing to enable Openreach to close down its increasingly obsolete network of copper cables. It's obviously, you don't need me to say that it's very expensive and inefficient to run two networks, and we want to give them an ability to simplify their business and get the and accelerate full fibre and improve the business case for doing so. So we have proposals here for a two-year transition. Once they've got the network built in a particular location, they can get within 2 years they'll be free of pricing regulation on their copper-based products, which would allow them to price as they see fit. And I think you could speculate that they would have the opportunity, therefore, to price in a way that would force their wholesale customers to move to their full fibre network. And that will accelerate the returns that they can get on that network. So those are the two areas I wanted to focus on in terms of substance, but I also just wanted to make the general point that what we've tried to do through this whole process is provide a consistent consistency in of our approach. This builds on the previous things we've done around duct and pole to encourage people to come into the infrastructure market. It's also providing kind of certainty and predictability, which is what investors say they want from the sector in the UK, and I hope that's your perception of what we're doing. I'm going to hand over to Dave now to just go into some of the more details. Dave, okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jonathan. So it's probably worth me just starting off to set out our high-level approach here. So we talk about promoting investment and competition. So, and those two things we see going hand in hand. So there are some parts of the UK where we actually think there can be competitive investment in these networks. Those areas, by the way, we refer to as Area 2. I'll go into them in more detail. And in those areas, our approach is very much to promote investment by Openreach, BT and other operators. We also recognise that there are some areas where competitive investment is less likely. We refer to those areas as Area 3. And in those areas, we don't want to give up on them. We still want to promote commercial investment. And we have looked to sort of build a regulatory approach that we think de-risks the investment and supports that. And again, I will go into that in more detail. So there is both something in this for Openreach, BT and the other operators. So moving on to slide 3. Proposals addressing regulatory enablers identified by Openreach. So this is really sort of Openreach-centric. So a while back, Openreach identified 3 regulatory enablers that it felt were important to support its investment case in fibre. And we believe that the proposals we've set out here today fully address those. The first one of the enablers is is about copper retirement balanced approach. And Jonathan's already mentioned what we're sort of doing in this area. But we are fully looking to support the migration from the old copper network to the new fibre network and the closure of the old copper network. And in doing this, actually allowing a higher price for the equivalent fibre products. I'll go into that in a bit more detail on the next slide, just to show you exactly what we're proposing there. The next enabler is about the fair treatment of legacy copper investments. Now, this is really about avoiding stranded copper assets and stranded copper investments. And our approach here is subtly different between the Area 2 and the Area 3. So the Area 2 potentially competitive. So what are we doing here? Well, we're proposing, as Jonathan says, to index prices rather than have cost-orientated prices. We believe that this will inject more margin into the network layer and that will actually support investment by both Openreach and indeed other competitors. In terms of Openreach, this extra margin will allow it to accelerate the recovery of its legacy copper investments, thereby avoiding stranded assets. In the case of Area 3, the non-competitive areas, our proposal there, and again I'll go into this in a bit more detail in one of the later slides, but is to adopt a regulatory approach which actually underwrites and de-risks the investment, and we can actually control the depreciation profile of those assets and ensure that they don't become stranded. The final enabler was the fair bet and our approach to that. It's probably worth just being clear so that everyone's on the same page in terms of what the fair bet is. And this is where a company faces downside risks, so if the investment fails, they potentially lose, you know, that it's actually a reasonable that they should enjoy the upside returns in the event that the investment succeeds. So this is the fair bet, and this is a principle that we've always supported and continue to support. In the past, and with the FTTC investment, Openreach did face significant downside risks on demand and willingness to pay, and in part that was to do with the way that the regulatory construct wrapped around it, because we continued to have and regulate the old network, so consumers could have stayed on the old network and not used the new one, and so that was a significant risk. So therefore, when we did look to regulate that, we obviously factored in those downside risks when we was considering regulation. For this fibre investment, we're actually proposing to take a slightly different approach to the fair bet, in that actually we're going to focus quite hard on de-risking the downside risks faced. And you can see that we're doing that in the way that we're supporting the migration from the copper network, sort of, so de-risk things like demand. We're not having cost-orientated prices, so in terms of willingness to pay, and indeed having higher prices. So our approach here is very much one of looking to de-risk the risk sides of the fair bet. In terms of going forwards, well, if competition emerges, and we hope in a lot of areas it will do, then in fact our position is that we'll deregulate that area. So talk of fair bet in those situations doesn't really come into it. But, you know, there is a chance that regulation is necessary in the future. And again, in doing that, we will absolutely look at the upfront downside risks that were faced. In Area 3, and I'll go into that in a bit more detail in a moment, but the approach there is to de-risk it through the way that we set charge controls for the old and the new services. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, slide 4, copper retirement. So clearly we recognise that it would be inefficient to run both the old and the new fibre networks in parallel for a prolonged period of time. So we're very keen, and what we set out here is a set of proposals which supports the transition in a very rapid way from that old network to the new network and the subsequent closure of the old network. So in terms of the detail, what we're proposing here is on an exchange area by exchange area basis, and there's about 5,500 of those, when the coverage of fibre hits 75%, we'll actually start to roll back on regulation. And the first thing we would do at that point is we will actually no longer require Openreach to supply new copper services. So this is known as stop sell. And so what that means is all new orders, moves and upgrades will have to be on fibre. 2 years after introducing the stop sell, and once the rollout is nearer complete, we'd actually propose to remove all charge controls from the copper network. The idea there, and Jonathan mentioned at the beginning, is that at this point Openreach could use relative pricing to encourage migration from the old to the new network.
Can I just interject there from my side? It's Jonathan here. I think the stop sell, which they talked about, is hugely important because it's up to Openreach, obviously, but they could make a decision once they've built out 75% of a particular exchange area with fibre. We're permitting them to stop selling copper services should they wish to do so. Now, if you look at their customer base, you've got potentially sort of quite significant churn on the base, and that's not just, I don't mean competitive churn there, I mean the churn you get where consumers upgrade between services, consumers that go from ADSL to fibre to the curb services, to their GEA network. That will mean that this change in the regulation gives Openreach the opportunity to move customers quite quickly. So it's not just the 2 years time frame, there is also this stop sell, and given the quantity of churn there is, then this is coming, this can potentially come quite soon in terms of people being moved onto their network.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so moving on to slide 5. So let's have a look at what's in it for the other potential investors, so the non-VT investors. But we think we're actually proposing a number of things and have done a number of things to support investment by other companies. In particular, access to BT's ducts and poles looks to lower the upfront costs and the time to deploy networks by these type of providers. We've talked about indexing prices and leaving greater margin at the network layer. Again, that will help the investments in these cases. And we've also talked about the fact that we will only regulate what we consider to be the entry level product, which is a 40 meg product, and actually give pricing flexibility above that, again giving more sort of margin and pricing flexibility for those investors. So we think that this actually creates an environment where there's actually more incentives for seekers to think about alternatives to Openreach. We are aware that these investors are concerned about actions that could be taken by Openreach in the short term to undermine them, and we've got an ongoing monitoring exercise to make sure that there isn't anti-competitive behaviour. We're happy for competition on the merits, but not otherwise. And the last point on this slide, which has come up a few times, an area of concern is that Openreach would use localised pricing to try and drive out competition or deter competition in the early days, and this is an area that we're actually looking to prevent doing. But it would be subject to a case-by-case basis. If there was objective justification, we could consider otherwise. So moving on to the next slide, slide six. So the proposal for the non-competitive areas, area three, which in this consultation we believe it represents about 30% of the UK, 30% of premises that is. And what we think here is despite having duct and pole access, that actually competitive investment of a significant level is quite unlikely. So we're not expecting a heavy competitive dynamic here. So our approach here is to try and build incentives to incentivise Openreach to build. And what we've come up with is what we've called the regulatory asset-based approach to setting charge controls. And very simply, this is it's cost-oriented, but the idea is that should Openreach invest in fibre, rather than treat that separately, we would capture those costs, include it in the broader asset base, and actually sort of spread it across the whole range of services within these areas, thus de-risking that investment. Now, the way we've set it out in the document is we've sort of said, we'll have a CPI minus X control, but if investment takes place, then we will increase prices to allow for that, and we've called that the plus K, so it's a CPI minus X plus K. We are aware, because BT has sort of made comments to us, that they're thinking of committing to deployment in this area. And they would be looking for us to build their commitments into the charge controls and possibly have indexation in these areas from the outset. That is something that we would be keen to pursue. So if we get commitments to build, we could factor them into the calculation up front rather than have an after-the-event type approach. In these areas, of course, there's going to be areas that actually commercial money is just not going to go to, and this is very much where any government funding would come in. So the government has announced the possibility of a £5 billion intervention. That would be in this area, and we believe that it can work hand in hand with the approach that we've set out here. So some of this 30% could be commercial under the RAB type model, and some of it could be government funded. So also in this area, and the last point on the slide, is for leased lines, we think that a better form of access for access seeking leased lines is to have dark fibre rather than Ethernet-type leased lines, and we're proposing to have a cost-based dark fibre remedy in this area for those purposes. So that is a quick walk through what we've put into the proposals today. We believe these are very pro-investment, pro-competition, you know, in terms of the competition from the duct and pole side, in terms of the investment more generally, the fact that we're indexing prices and not having cost orientation, and actually to support the whole case of fibre, our support for the copper retirement and the transition to the fibre network. So these regulations we will be looking to bring into place next year in March, and they would be running for 5 years until 26, allowing a long period of stability. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. I mean, I think just to sort of wrap up, it's easy to, you guys are hard-bitten investors and analysts, so I won't use hyperbole, but I actually do think that we, through these proposals, are removing the roadblocks to investment in fibre, and I do think they transform the economics. It'd be interesting to get your views and whether you think that's the case. I think it's a significant change from historically what Ofcom has done, and I think it does get the right balance between ensuring that investors get fair returns, but also we protect consumers. That ends our presentation. I think we've got do you want to just take us through what the next steps are?
Sure.
By the way, I do apologise if you can hear background noise. We do have the builders in, so I apologise to all of you on the call if you're getting any background noise. I can tell you it's a lot more background noise in the room, but go ahead.
Right. So, as Jonathan said earlier, we've got quite a number of people on the call, so just in case you don't get around to ask a question, do get in touch with myself, Rohit Goyle, Analyst Relations Manager here at Ofcom, analyst.relations@ofcom.org.uk. Operator, we're ready to take questions, please.
Thank you. Okay, everyone, if you wish to ask a question, it's star one on your telephone. So it's star one on your telephone to ask a question. Okay, and the first question comes from Michael Bishop. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks very much. I'll just keep it to one, given you've got a lot of people on the call, and thanks for hosting. I was just wanted to follow up. You gave a lot of clarity around how you believe that you're changing the fair bet principle, you know, in effect, sort of underpinning less downside risk. But I think in the past, you've focused on the call in terms of suggesting that after this five-year regulatory period, in all reality, there would probably be a subsequent five-year regulatory period where you, you know, wouldn't look to adjust wholesale pricing. So I was just wondering whether you have any commentary around the sort of fair bet principle beyond this five-year regulatory cycle. Thanks.
Yeah, we didn't mention that, but I mean, I'm happy to reiterate that our intention would be that you know, we wouldn't return to cost orientation in a second cycle, so for the period for the next market review after this one. So, you know, 10 years of stability and certainty. Now, if my general counsel was here, she would point out that I can't actually be bound by that because, you know, we will have to look at the facts at the end of this current five-year period. But certainly our intention would be to provide that kind of 10-year certainty.
Great, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. And the next question comes from Mandeep Singh. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. It's Mandeep at Redburn. The question is on the sort of 30% of the UK where you've said if BT commits to invest, then obviously those costs can be included up front. I mean, can you just sort of give us some parameters of what would be, how would we define a commitment to invest? I mean, how many homes are in that area? And what would be seen as over the five-year period from April 21 to 26, what would be a reasonable commitment by BT, like 3 million lines, 4 million lines, 5 million lines? Can you just give us some flavour for what you would see as a commitment? Thank you.
Okay, I will try, and naturally there will be a range on this, and there are ranges in the document, and in fact you could probably triangulate some of the numbers. So Area 3 represents about 9 million premises in total. When, you know, we've looked at some of the numbers clearly on producing this conduct, but we would obviously have to go into some more detail at the time to see exactly what the rollout profile was and which areas. But, you know, I think as a starters, and just to put people in the right place, I think that we would be in the area of a few million would have to be the sort of level of commitment in order to sort of get close to an index price in these areas. So what we're doing there is we're sort of looking at the difference between the charge control absent build and what index prices would be and what that wedge is worth and how much it should buy. But, you know, more work would be needed because we'd need detail from BT, but we do think that it would be in the
7 million.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just follow up very quickly?
Okay.
I mean, if we were to sort of think of a ballpark number around 4 million to put into our models, would we be way off the mark, or is that a reasonable sort of number to stick in models, for example?
I would have thought it's a good central case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And the next question comes from Paul Sidney. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks very much. Again, just one question, please. I was just wondering if you could give us a bit of an understanding of what level of discussions you've had with Open Reach and UK government over the past few months. I mean, clearly, we've been very upfront about it, the enablers and what it would ideally like, and we've seen what I think is a pretty encouraging press release in BT already this morning. So just be great to get a feel for, you know, just how interactive the discussions have been with BT and the UK government in coming up with this this very detailed proposal. Thank you.
Well, first of all, we're an independent regulator, so it's obviously in terms of the decisions we're making, the proposals we're making, they're our own, not the government. Although we're obviously, you know, very conscious of what the government strategy is, and we work very closely with them, particularly on the plans that they've announced for the £5 billion potential subsidies in rural areas, which is extremely complementary to what we're doing, and we can get into that if that's helpful. In terms of consultation, you know, the reality of our day jobs is that we spend an awful lot of time with stakeholders. So we've obviously had lots of contact and discussions with Openreach and BT, but also with TalkTalk and Sky, and with all of the other major stakeholders, CityFibre, HyperOptics. We meet all of these folk all the time, and we're very open to hearing their views, their opinions. You know, this is a consultation after all. And that's not just the larger players. We also meet with a lot of the smaller alternative network operators that are around the country.
That's very clear. Thank you.
Thank you. And the next one comes from John Cardis.
Thank you. If I may, two quick ones. First of all, where do you expect, do you think you might, there might be a need for further consultations over the next few months, trying to figure out whether these are going to be very substantive issues or not? And secondly, it would be lovely to get an idea of a case where geographic pricing would be allowed, please. Thank you.
Okay. Let's just take each one in turn. So in terms of future consultation, so I should start by saying that what we've tried to do here is to cover everything off in one document, which I know is quite a heroic sort of effort, but that's what we've tried to do, and that's why it's quite a heavy sort of document and quite a lot of pages. But realistically, you know, as we go through the year, there's bound to be areas that pop up that we'll need to sort of reconsult on. It's very difficult to sort of know where they might be. The normal areas to sort of give examples would be when we get new cost data that's sort of significantly different than we had anticipated, and therefore there might be some parts of the charge controls, and it doesn't necessarily have to be all of them. It could be something like the ancillary services or something. It's also possible areas like the copper switch off, you know, and the retirement, the bringing in more detail there is an area that possibly might need more consultation. But, you know, we're not planning on these. You know, we're planning on trying to go through without further consultations, but clearly we sort of accept and we can recognise that there'll be areas that probably will pop up, but those are the sort of areas. You asked, I think, for an example of where geographic pricing might be allowed because it's objectively justified. The obvious ones is if there are identifiable differences in costs. So, you know, we're talking about Area 2 here, so it's the first part of the hockey stick cost curve. So it's although there is a gradient into it, there isn't wild fluctuations, we believe. But, I mean, clearly, if Openreach identified that there was an area, a big town or city or something, where the costs for an identifiable reason were lower, and that was where people were competing against it aggressively on price and it wanted to sort of meet those competitive prices, then a cost-based justification would be one example, I'd suggest.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the next one comes from James Ratzer.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. Had two quick questions, please. The first one was just regarding price discounting by Openreach. I mean, you're making it clear that they're not going to be allowed to do any geographically targeted discounting. But, I mean, Openreach recently has been engaging in quite widespread discounting on its FTTC pricing. I mean, are they going to be allowed to do more widespread discounting on FTTP, which could make life tougher for some of the new entrants going forward? And secondly, just wanted to understand the methodology by which you've set the price uplift of £1.50 to £1.85 on the base 4010 price. Thank you.
Okay, I will try and pick up both those questions. So on the discounts, other than sort of geo-targeting of discounts, So what we've set out in this document is, you know, we recognise that in fact other sort of pricing structures and discount structures, you know, could be quite beneficial to the market in terms of encouraging take up and other things, but equally they could have downsides in terms of deterring competition. So we've looked at this in detail, and we was toying, and if you read the document you can see what we was doing, of do we sort of say that these should be by default banned, if you like, but we would allow them if they could be justified, or do we go the other way and allow them but potentially be prepared to go in and change them or prevent them if we think that they would have anti-competitive situations. Where we come out and what we propose in this consultation is the second of those two, where the default is that discounts are allowable, but we actually reserve the position that if we think they have anti-competitive sort of effect, that we would look to sort of change them or prevent them. So that's the position that we've put out there. And just to complete that, we've actually set out some criteria that we would use when assessing whether or not they would have sort of anti-competitive effects, and so that people know in advance how we'd make that assessment. In terms of the fibre price premium, the £1.50 to £1.85, this has been calculated on what we think the extra value that the fibre product, the 40 meg fibre product, brings over the 40 meg essentially FTTC product. And the value comes from two areas. The value comes from the consumer, and from the consumer point of view, the first additional value you get is with a fibre product. If you're told it's 40 megs, it will be 40 megs rather than some other speed depending on your line length, and so that's one sort of part of the consumer value. And the fact that actually the line is more stable and reliable. The other part of the value comes from the supply chain. And that's the suppliers actually supplying the retail services to consumers. If they're using a fibre product that's more stable and has lower fault rates, then their sort of supply cost should be lower because they're going to get less customer calls and issues arising. And we've tried to quantify those two areas, and those two things make up that £1.50 to £1.85 range. It's fair to say that at the moment, the first one of those, the consumer value, is the majority of that number.
And is it correct to say that that consumer value then that has a more qualitative aspect in calculating that? Just because in the past your charge controls have always been very quantitative.
So, I mean, we've tried not to overcomplicate this area. And what we've sort of done in assessing the value to consumers is we've looked at the pricing points of different products, retail pricing points of different products at different speeds, and what consumers seem to be willing to pay for, you know, going from, say, a 40 meg product to a 55 meg product and so on. And we've taken a number of points and tried to work out what we think the willingness to pay sort of per megabit of guaranteed speed is. And then what we've done is we've sort of said, look, what's the typical speed that you would get on FTTC? And it's probably about 36, 37. You know, what's the guaranteed speed you would get on the fiber product? It will be the 40. So what is the sort of value that we think that suggests to the consumer? And that sort of is where that number comes from. It's a fairly simple and crudish approach, but it's a way of just trying to just get a handle on what we think the value to consumers and their willingness to pay is.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. And the next question comes from Jerry Dallas.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my question. Just returning to the issue of geographically targeted pricing. At present, Openreach has a couple of GEA FTTP schemes. It has a localized marketing offer in the Fibre First cities. And then last month, they also launched a volume discount offer, also available across Fibre First premises. As things stand, would both of those constructions be things that you would be willing to endorse? And my second question is, could you please clarify for us a mechanism for redefining a potentially competitive area as fully competitive? Is that a decision that just gets taken with every five-year cycle in the market review process? Thank you.
Okay. So let's try and address the first one of those, which is going to be quite hard for me to address, in part because I'm not totally familiar with the pricing schemes that you're talking about. I'm aware of some of them. I don't think I can sit here and say that I think they're bad or that we would sort of endorse them. They are not something that is being brought to our attention in a negative sort of way at the moment. If they were to, we would look at them. We would need to look at them in the round and on a case-by-case basis. We don't have a position on them. In terms of your second question, what we've not done here is we've not pre-set out criteria that would say if this is met, then, you know, this area would be reclassified as competitive, i.e. moving from Area 2 to Area 1, I guess, is the proposal. So our default position is that actually we would need to look at it, and normally that would be done on the market review cycle. However, you know, we are conscious that this is a five-year review, and, you know, a lot can happen in that period of time. So we are open to the notion that areas could become more competitive and that we should and indeed could open up and do a look at certain areas to see whether or not we think that the competitive landscape changed to a point that we need to change our regulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the next one comes from Carl Murdoch-Smith.
Hi, thank you very much. Two questions from me, please. I mean, firstly, I was just wondering, in your view, what would you say has changed most since the consultation you put out in March last year? I'd say most of this looks incredibly consistent with that, so I'd be interested in what you think has changed in terms of direction rather than just detail. And then secondly, kind of following up on Jerry's question, in terms of when you're thinking about Area 1 and Area 2, just how you think about cable within that, in particular, what counts as multiple networks, and two counts as multiple, and also how would you consider cable, either in the case where it's not opened to wholesale, and in the case if it were open to wholesale, would you take into consideration cable? Thank you.
Just on the first, Jonathan here, I mean, I'll let Dave add to it and then deal with your second issue. My perspective, and you know, something I think is really important for the people in the school to understand, is on the transition from copper to fibre. And one of the things that we were, you know, there were submissions from Openreach around, was that we'd set the trigger for when we would start to transfer and allow them freedom on the copper to price up the copper, was the that they had to build to 100% of a particular exchange area. And now we've reduced that to 75%. I think that is actually quite a significant change. And that does, I think, remove any sort of roadblock to start that process of closing down the copper network, and in particular moving and migrating consumer, the providers, onto the new fibre network. I think that's a very significant one. I don't know if there's others you want to highlight, Dave.
Yeah, so I think that is one of the significant changes. Of course, that earlier document was us trying to elicit views from industry and others about the direction, and it lacked quite a lot of detail. So I think what we've done here is we've actually sort of put quite a lot of detail in the areas, in particular around the fibre premium. We didn't have numbers in the March document. We now do have numbers. And we've actually worked up a lot about the regulatory asset-based approach in Area 3 and exactly how we would do that, and actually have set out the calculations. So I think those are the big differences. In terms of our treatment of cable, effectively, we do count the nape of the cable networks. You know, it always features in our assessment of the competitive landscape, and in fact always has done. And we haven't actually made a difference, really, about whether or not it wholesales or not. You know, the fact that it's there and the fact that it's got customers on it and it's actually able to serve a certain level of service means that it's in the calculation and in the assessment.
That's great. So is that a confirmation that the half of the country where there is cable would be classified as a competitive area in that case?
So at the moment, what we've done is our area two, our potentially competitive areas, is broadly, it's those areas where there is some existing network competition and the prospects of more investment from competitors. And in fact, cable features there because it's an existing network. So in fact, the Virgin Media cable network plays a big part in our definition of area two as being potentially competitive.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and just to remind everyone, if you wish to ask a question, it is star one on your telephone. But we do have another question, and that one comes from Stephen Hard. Go ahead, Stephen.
Oh, hi. Yeah, it's Stephen Hard from HSBC. So my question is, why is there dark fibre regulation as well as DPA regulation in the area three? Why do you need both? It seems, at least to me, that that's unnecessary duplication and complexity. I think this plugs into some of the earlier questions about what would, under what circumstances would an area be deemed to fall into the first area category. It's going to be quite hard to convince investors that you're serious about deregulation when the terms under which something would shift into Area 1, you know, aren't set out in detail, and when you've actually got multiple potentially redundant layers of regulation in Area 3, i.e. dark fibre as well as DPA.
Hi, Stephen. Let's try and pick up both those points. So your first point about Area 3 and dark fibre. Effectively, our position here really is that we're not really putting a lot of weight on DPA being effective in Area 3. And that's in large part because of the information that we've gathered from the various network operators and what their plans are and where they would tend to use it, which is a function of sort of density of customers and so on. So in truth, in Area 3, we're not really expecting DPA to be that successful. So what we're then saying is if people aren't using DPA to build their own fibre networks, what should the regulatory sort of access products be? And in the case of leased lines, what we're saying is we think dark fibre should be the regulatory access product, as opposed to the Ethernet products that we previously regulated. So that's how that fits into that space. In terms of Area 1 and the criteria, we actually do in the document set out how we would assess the competitive conditions for Area 1 and in broad terms what we actually see we think needs to happen. I don't think, you know, it is fairly obvious. We just need a certain level of competition, perhaps more than one player, who's got a reasonable scale and has got a reasonable track record that we think that they're going to be sort of about for a few years. You know, and that, yeah, you know, I'm simplifying, it's in the document, but please read it. But that's our position there, you know. Yeah, you know, we'd be basically looking for three reasonably stable operators would be our criteria.
Okay, but forgive me, if the DPA is something you're not expecting to be used in Area 3, why don't you withdraw it?
So, I mean, it's a fair point, Stephen. I think, you know, if you knew precisely where the boundary lied between Area 2 and 3, then, you know, I think that would be a reasonable sort of challenge. At this stage, you know, precisely where that boundary is, there is uncertainty,
You know, so withdrawing it and trying to burn that boundary in doesn't seem like a necessary thing to do, and probably not even really an ideal thing to do. We sort of think that it will just naturally find its own position, and we think that's a better way of doing it because it puts less sort of stress on how we define that boundary today.
Okay, thanks for that answer. I mean, I'd just like to, I suppose, make one observation, which is I do think the geo-pricing topic that's come up is extremely important. I'm very interested in your answers. But I do think that investors will regard it as very important that we have some measures of flexibility to balance the cost.
Okay, noted. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next one comes from Nick Lyle.
Yeah, all right, guys. I'm actually finding it a bit difficult to hear you because there's obviously. I hope you can hear me. Yeah. Just quickly, it's a very, very simple one on the timing. I mean, I think John there mentioned that possibility of further consultations in his question, but are you under pressure here to speed up the timing? We've heard a lot, obviously, from government and their enablers, but how much pressure are you under just to get on with this thing? And what's the earliest the process could be finished, in your view? Would those extra consultations add a great deal of time? Could you give us a bit of an idea of the timescale, please?
Hello, Nick. I'm not sure how familiar we are with the way we do market reviews in the past. I mean, it's not uncommon for us to do smaller, narrower consultations for the reasons Dave gave earlier. You know, why do we do it? I mean, just to stand back from this, you know, actually it's investors that typically tell us all the time that we should take a careful and considered approach to this with certainty, providing certainty at the forefront of what we're doing. I'm looking around the team actually to see whether we're getting lots of pressure. We're not actually getting lots of pressure from any stakeholders to speed up, as you say. I think stakeholders typically are more interested in that we get the right answer and that they have adequate opportunity to talk to us about concerns they have with the regulation and that we do a lot of the sort of things we're doing today. So, no, I'm not hearing any concerns. I suppose the only concerns have come from BT. I think they have occasionally said, you know, there's some uncertainty about when things are happening. To be honest, I mean, BT ought to know this game. They've been in this game for 20 years. So, but we don't hear it from other stakeholders particularly. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Yeah, the only thing I would add, of course, is that, you know, we're not sitting here today in a sort of a vacuum of regulation. We do have regulation for lease lines and for broadband services that all plays out until March 21. And, you know, the approach we're taking here is to just sort of build the next sort of regulatory environment that goes beyond that. So, you know, we have a position that everyone knows and understands, and we actually think that allowing that to run its course and then just picking up from that point going forwards is the sensible thing to do.
We've been kind of doing a program of stuff, Nick. I mean, you'll have seen in the past we did the business connectivity. We also did duct and poles. So we've done a number of things over the last few years as part of this program of encouraging full fibre investment in infrastructure.
Yeah, I'm understood on that. It's just, I suppose, the problem from a BT point of view is it's waiting to give guidance, and that's the, I'd say, you know, as a bit of feedback, that's the investor concern from the pure equity market investors, is that they, you know, they want to see this guidance on CapEx, cash flows and dividend, and of course, that doesn't happen until potentially you get full clarity, and that's dependent on you. So, yeah, but thank you very much for the answer. That's great.
Well, I'm going to come back to you because I think it's really important, because that has often said, but, you know, these things can be appealed as well. So now BT is in this game. They know how this process works. I know they've been saying that. I have to say, I also hear from within BT that other people within BT say to us, just get this right and take the time that you're taking. So it's not exactly the same message that we receive, that we've got to speed up.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, just remind everyone again, if you wish to ask a question, it is *1 on your telephone. We do have the next question, and that one comes from Steve Malcolm.
Yeah, morning, guys. I'll go for one question with three parts. That's three parts. That's one question. just on coming back to geographic de-averaging and pricing, I mean, on the current construct, do you expect wholesale prices to be different in Area 2 from Area 3 in the absence of government funding? And then following on from that, are you hopeful or confident that the £5 billion, you know, referenced in the press release this morning will somehow level out the prices between the two regions? And finally, when do you expect to get clarity? Is that the March budget that you expect the government to lay out exactly how that money is going to flow into fibring up Britain? Thank you.
Now, on the last point, I don't think we know at this stage. So, but Dave, do you want to pick up any other points?
Yeah, I was going to say, Steve, I can probably try and answer the first two. The last one, probably not. So, in terms of the wholesale pricing area 2, area 3, there is a potential for it to be different. And in fact, if you actually look at our sort of you know, if you think we're proposing indexation in price in Area 2, and we are saying one form of the RAB could be a CPI minus X plus K in Area 3, now if we went with that, actually initially we would actually end up with lower wholesale prices in Area 3 compared to Area 2. And then, of course, if rollout of fibre in Area 3 took place, then those prices would move back up. That's one of the reasons that, in fact, we are quite attracted to, in fact, accepting commitments for deployment in Area 3 and indexing prices. We don't have those price movements. It keeps it much more constant. And, of course, we get the certainty of the fact that we know that consumers are going to benefit from the build. So there could be differences, but there are ways to mitigate that, or there are alternative options that we're looking at in terms of the commitments. In terms of the £5 billion, I mean, we haven't done the detailed numbers, but I mean, we've looked at the shape of the cost curves and we've looked at what the £5 million buys, and it does appear to us that, you know, in our first sort of walk through this, that £5 billion could in fact pay for that hockey stick part of the cost curve and actually level out the pricing in Area 3. To something which is much more analogous to the Area 2 type prices.
Okay, but you have no real visibility as to when we will know how that £5 billion is going to be allocated?
No, it's a matter of the government. They didn't just come back
in terms
from holidays.
Of the government does it, no.
Yeah, they need a bit of time, I'm sure, to sort that. I'm not sure even when the budget, if the budget's been set to pay for it. I think March, isn't it? Yeah.
11th of March.
I'm sure that will come out shortly, but I think it's a little bit early days for the government to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And the next one comes from Karen Egan.
Good morning. I've got a question about the charge control in Area 3. And essentially, wondering whether the charge control in Area 3 should be higher because it is presumably more expensive to serve on average. And therefore, kind of why is the base the national average?
Okay, let me try and answer that. So when we set charge controls, we're very much concerned about cost recovery. We currently have national data from BT and Openreach. We sort of made the assessment that in fact setting charges in this way would ensure cost recovery and was actually the most simple and straightforward thing to do in terms of data availability and monitoring. So we've taken that approach. In terms of our costs higher in these areas than elsewhere, maybe, but it always appears to us that it's not quite as straightforward as you think, because I think if you're comparing sort of, you know, like for like, then it probably is the case. But of course, remember, these areas, there is no competition, which means that actually you have much higher market shares, so you actually get higher utilisation, and that can balance the factors. So the difference often isn't as much as you might think.
Okay, yeah, makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. And the next one comes from James Britton.
Operator, I think we'll take two more questions before we end the call, so go ahead, James.
Good morning, thanks. Thanks, guys. So my question is linked to the sort of views around the business market I mean, I think this is the first document where you're integrating the approach on residential and business. But just wanted to understand whether there's any real differentiation of your objectives as you look at the ambition to incentivize investments across the market. You know, did you also want to inject more margin into build programs to business premises around the UK and draw new competition into that market as well? As you just comment on the business side.
Okay, I mean, I'll start with a short answer and then explain it in a bit more detail. I think the short answer is yes, you know, injecting margin and having more competition in networks there is part of what we're doing. But it's not really as straightforward as that. What we sort of see here is when you start thinking about people building new fibre networks, is it's very difficult to de-link the two. You know, people will invariably just roll out fibre in an area and serve whoever they can with it, whether that be businesses or whether that be residential customers. So really we come at it from the other way, and we sort of think that it is nonsensical for us to try and separate the two and treat them differently, because we'll end up creating tensions between them. You know, if we are trying to embark on a strategy of promoting investment and deployment of fibre, you know, our view is that we've got to really treat them together and just promote that fibre investment. And what people do with it and exactly where they deploy it, well, that's up to them as we go forwards.
Okay, thanks.
One more question.
Thank you. So your last question then will be from David Wright. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, guys. David from Bank of America, and thanks for taking the call. Could you just talk a little more on the fair bet? It seems like your focus is, as very clearly said, on maybe trying to reduce the downside risks, which would probably, by implication, reduce the kind of return on capital, return on invested capital ceiling. Does that make sense? You know, you're looking to probably maybe cap returns at a slightly lower level than before, because your argument is you're reducing the risk. Is that right?
So I think so, but it's worth thinking about how this sort of plays out. So with the fair bet, what we're talking about is what we take into account at a future point in time when we're thinking of regulating these type of investments. And what we did with FTTC is, you know, we looked at all of those downside risks that existed at the front, you know, in the early part of the project, and we asked ourselves whether or not it was reasonable for us to intervene at this point in time with this type of regulation. Had Openreach and BT been sufficiently rewarded with the upside? Now, the point is that we would do exactly the same here. We're not proposing any difference. It's just that when we go back and look at what the risks were, if they genuinely were less because they were mitigated, then that would factor into our decision and the structure of the regulation that we were proposing to do. So that's how it works. I mean, at one level, you know, I guess you're right that, you know, that with FTTC, you know, we saw a 15% return, and we sort of said that we felt that had more than compensated for the investment. You know, it has got to be true that if we think that those initial downside risks were less, that we would potentially take the same decision at a slightly lower number.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Okay, thank you very much for the call today, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Jonathan.
Right. Thank you very much to everyone who joined the call. If you do have any follow-on questions, please do get in touch with me, analyst.relations@ofcom.org.uk. I'd like to apologise again for the background noise. We will have a replay and a transcript available on the website as soon as we can, so hopefully that can help clarify for anyone who was struggling a little bit with the noise.
Thanks from my side too, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Thank you, Jonathan and David. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes your conference for today. You may all now disconnect. Thanks for joining, and enjoy the rest of your day.